Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, standing with all Californians as we address the coronavirus emergency together, on the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, we take a look at how the coronavirus pandemic is fueling hunger concerns throughout the Valley. And we find out how local restaurants are fighting to stay in business. But first, we're going to turn to the 2020 census. In spite of COVID-19, it's still taking place. In the past, community organizers across the San Joaquin Valley would go door to door asking people to fill out the form that plays a big role in federal funding equations, but not anymore. As FM89's Maddie Bolaños reports, there are new strategies for getting the word out.
Mi Familia Vota is an organization that focuses on census outreach for communities who typically don't fill out the form. Prior to COVID-19, the organization had planned to co-host events with Fresno Barrios Unidos and Fresno Unified School District. That all came to a screeching halt in late March.
We immediately adjusted and started doing phone banking outreach and increasing our social media presence and also, you know, pivoting to Facebook Live.
That's Samuel Molina, the California State Director for Mi Familia Vota. The number of people who have filled out this census is down by about 10% compared to the 2010 census, he says. To bring the number up, Mi Familia has turned to phone banking with 28,000 calls since mid-March.
It's allowed us to call more people, spend more time making phone calls than having to drive to do door-to-door in person.
Phone banking and social media are also part of the strategy for Act for Women and Girls, a youth-led nonprofit based in Tulare County. Karina Gallardo, the communications associate, says organizers have learned they can reach out to a larger audience now that they're operating online, and they can target specific areas.
We can like pick the region as well, and so we're picking regions that are also not the main cities in Tulare County, so it's going out further into more of like the rural areas.
Organizers are also teaming up. ACT has partnered with Visalia-based The Source LGBT Center to get the word out. Source board member Katia Clark says that's helped them reach a larger audience.
We've been able to access people in the Latinx community, which sometimes get overlooked. And because of the citizenship question that was potentially supposed to be on the census, there's a lot of misinformation about what the census is used for and what questions people are being asked.
Clark adds being an immigrant and a Spanish speaker has made those efforts to combat misinformation easier.
Because I've had that immigrant experience as far as living in fear. So it's one of those things of calming fears is just letting them know I understand the fear. I see the fear. I've lived that fear. And I'm telling you, I get it, but here's the accurate information.
The Source is also shifting from doing an outdoor Pride event in late May to hosting it online. Noah Deeds, the events and fundraising coordinator, said the Source will take questions and remind people about why the census matters. Without an accurate count, communities will miss out on federal funding that supports education, housing, and childcare.
It's going to be a virtual event that's going to be the same day, and we're going to have like a little census spot there as well. It's not the same, but I mean, it's the best that we can do at this point.
Churches are also playing a role. Faith in the Valley's Ariana Martinez says working with local churches in their online messaging has helped gain the trust of older Latinx community members.
We're trying to figure out how we can support them in ensuring that they can also give a message around the importance of census and how that connects to our faith and how that connects to this higher calling of caring for one another.
But not everyone has access to the internet. That's why Faith in the Valley is using other methods to reach people, says Martinez.
We work with a lot of churches that are doing food ministry, so it's trying to figure out how to ensure that they have the resources to let folks know the importance of filling out the census.
And Faith in the Valley is using its immigration hotline to remind people about the census and answer any questions or concerns callers may have. The census deadline has been pushed back from July to October. With Valley Public Radio News, I'm Maddie Bolaños.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Later in the show, you'll hear about the recent closure of one of Bakersfield's most cherished dining establishments, which led us to wonder how other restaurants in the Valley are staying afloat. To learn more about how the dining industry is coping with the pandemic, I spoke with the owners and operators of three well-known Fresno restaurants, Chuck Van Fleek from Vino Grill and Spirits, Paul Pearson of Chef Paul's Cafe, and J.J. Wetstead from Max's Bistro and Bar. To start out, I'd just like to do a roundtable and get a sense of how everybody's business is doing at the moment. J.J., let's go ahead and start with you.
Well, you know, business is down really close to 70% at our bistro. You know, we rely on that dine-in capability to make the numbers work. We had to adjust to bring ourselves in line with doing only 30% of our normal business, which unfortunately means the temporary layoff of most of my staff, well over 70% of my staff. And, you know, we've adjusted by just working really hard to stay in the public consciousness and provide a good service to the people that want the food service from us right now. And we are anxiously awaiting, patiently awaiting every day, new news as to when we will be allowed to open and what that even looks like when we're allowed to open.
Chef Paul, how is your business going?
Business is great. We have some pretty loyal customers that call and check on us and make sure that we're okay and order food for their food friends and family. They deliver it themselves. They'll get, you know, 15, 20 orders and go around and deliver it to their family members. And I'm thankful for that.
That's really remarkable to have that kind of commitment from your customer base. Can you give us an estimate from a percentage perspective of about how much your business is down?
Actually, we're probably down 30 to 35%. And like other food vendors, we had to lay off quite a few workers, but you know, we kept as many as we possibly could.
So, Chuck, I'd like to turn the conversation to you and hear about not only how business is going at Vino Grill and Spirits, but also what you're hearing from other restaurants, given your role as president of the California Restaurant Association Fresno chapter.
We're down about 65%. We're doing about 30 to 40 takeout orders a day. That's takeout delivery. We use ChowNow, Grubhub, and DoorDash. We do have a good amount of loyal customers because we've built up a wine club for so many years. They come in, and the fortunate thing is we are allowed to be open because of the restaurant, but we're also doing okay with the retail of wine sales to go. So we're in a little bit better position than some of the other ones, but it's taken a toll. Everybody's tired of seeing these numbers. Everybody's kind of scratching by. I talk to a lot of restaurants every single day, and it's tiring on all of us. Some restaurants have tried to make a go of it, and they've done a good job, but their model just isn't set for takeout and delivery. So 13 Prime is a wonderful example of somebody that they went out there, they tried to do everything they can. They've done a great job at it, but their model is such that they are dine-in only. So they're going to work throughout this weekend, through Sunday, and do their Mother's Day pickups. And then they're going to close it down until we're allowed to open our dining rooms again. So it's kind of what's going on. Everybody's just anxious and trying to get open.
JJ, you know, we do have Mother's Day coming up on Sunday. Are you hopeful that that's going to be a big day for Max's?
Yeah, I'll echo a little bit of what's been said already. We have a large following. We've been in business 23 years. So there are people that have a vested interest in keeping us alive and flourishing as much as we can during this time. So on Easter, we did a great job. We got out 75 meals on Easter to different families that wanted to come purchase that meal. And we're targeting that same amount of people for Mother's Day because it seems, you know, there's only so much room in the ovens to cook all the food. So we're kind of targeting that number again, about 75 families to get Mother's Day, either a ham meal that we've put together or a prime rib meal that we're putting together. And, you know, just again, to echo the sentiment of Chef Paul and Chuck is that, you know, our customers are, everybody in this community has a vested interest in keeping the restaurants that they love alive. And we're seeing a lot of that love out there, but it is starting to wear on the public too. They want to come in and enjoy a relaxing drink at the bar. And they want to have their banquets or family functions. And banquets and family functions for myself, and I know a lot of other restaurants, the banquets are a big part of our business that we're fortunately not going to see for a little bit.
Yeah, it's such an uncertain time. And it's been fascinating to see how so many restaurants are pivoting in order to stay as profitable as possible. Chuck, I'd like to speak, I'd love if you could speak about some of the other things that you've done to connect with your customers, including food boxes that you have made available. Can you talk about those?
Yeah, we started out, it was an idea that started from Robin over at Patio Cafe, and she was doing produce boxes. So what we did is we went to our suppliers and the produce people and local farmers and said, hey, what do you have that you need to sell? What can we try to move so that it'll help people in the community, because they may not be able to find everything? So we called it a community box, and we had a lot of people that would spend the $40 and pick it up themselves. But then I had a lot of people that would spend the $40 and we were to donate it to a worthy person or a cause or something like that. The real purpose for us to do that is we weren't making a lot of money on it, but it does allow us to bring in some people that didn't have any hours and get them to come in and stuff all the boxes, get those all prepared and get them ready to go out to the families or the charitable organization.
That's really lovely. It's such a reminder of how connected we all are as a community. Chef Paul, you know, keeping a restaurant profitable under normal circumstances is no simple task because the profit margins are notoriously thin in the restaurant industry. Given the situation that you're in right now, I mean, it sounds like you're doing relatively well given the circumstances, but have you projected out what is the timeline for you? How long can you maintain your business without opening up your dining room?
You know, as far as the restaurant does well, but we were more relied more on the catering end of it. And we had, just one day I had so many weddings and anniversaries canceled. And I offered them all their deposits back that they had made. I said, just stop by, pick up your deposit. I don't want to keep it. And we're fortunate. Out of all the parties that canceled, I did not have one client say that they wanted their money back. They all said, you know what, Paul, just hang on to it. We're going to do something. We want to make sure you're okay. And we had 40 to 50 catering parties to cancel, and not one of them wanted their deposit back. So we're very fortunate. And we're not in the high rent district, so I can hang on indefinitely.
That's great to hear, and I'm sure great for the fans of your restaurant to hear as well. You know, let's shift gears and talk a little bit about what the future may look like. JJ, is Max's already putting in some kind of protocol or doing planning for what your dine-in service might look like once we reach that phase in relaxing the stay-at-home directive?
Well, I sit on the board of the California Restaurant Association with Chuck Van Fleet, and we are getting good information on a daily basis as to what the protocols are going to be. So we had some idea, and we've been talking about this from day one. You know, I have a phone call with Chuck at least 3 or 4 times a week, and we talk things through a little bit. So we're all coming up with what our best practices are going to be for keeping guests and workers alike safe to come back to work and to, you know, try to fulfill our love for what we do for the community. You know, you talked about the profit margins for restaurants, and, you know, nobody's doing this to get rich. I love seeing smiles on people's faces and providing great meals and letting people leave our establishment happy. It's a place of happiness, and it brings us lots of happiness. I don't think that we're going to be so overly protocoled that we're going to kill the happiness inside our restaurants. The public at large is thirsty and hungry to be back out in these facilities. It's something that's expressed to me every day when people are picking up their food and doing to-go orders with us. You know, the number one thing said is, I cannot wait to come enjoy this food back in the restaurant. So we're going to make that safe for them when they do come back. All my workers that are working right now, they're going to be the vanguard that's teaching the rest of the people that come back in what we need to do in order to keep our guests safe. From hand washing, sanitizing, all the cleanliness practices that are being put in place right now. I know that the CRA and even the NRA have been working extremely hard to get to the powers that be different protocols that will allow us to open. And we're just all looking for the final draft on that, and I'm ready to move in whatever direction I'm told to move in. It's just no fun waiting to be told when we can do that.
And Chuck, can you say some more about that and maybe speak specifically about the kind of changes that are taking place in your kitchens and in your restaurants in general?
Well, yeah. I mean, when we open up, we're going to be 100% reservations. We want to make sure, for two reasons. We don't want a whole lot of people congregating and standing around and being close to each other, which is one thing. But also, it's a way for us to track the people that have been in the restaurant. They want the state and the city, they want us to be able to go back and say, if somebody got COVID, who are the other people that could possibly be exposed to that? So by taking reservations, we have all the name and information on how to track somebody down. We've spaced out our tables to be 6 feet apart, where normally in my dining room, I'd be able to hold 60. Now we're going to be able to hold about 30. So our banquet room, unfortunately, it was 60 people, and now it's going to be down to about 26. So we're going to lose a lot of seating, which is going to cut into the profit margins. You got to make sure that you have adequate people on, but you can't be overstaffed. And then we also have a lot of sanitation stations that we are putting out. We've got the stands with the touchless sanitizer. We're going to have single-use menus where we print them one time on paper and then we throw them away. All of our staff will be wearing masks or shields. So there's a lot of things that are going to play into this. And we haven't seen the final draft, but we've seen what the state has, what the California Restaurant Association out of Sacramento has put together. And then there's also a few tweaks to what we've put together for the local chapter for Fresno CRA. The state says seating of 10 people per table at the max, and they all have to be living in the same house. And I think the local, we set a 6, but we didn't say that it had to be from the same house.
So there's no way to answer this question, and I admit that up front. But the thing that I think everybody is asking is, what are the long-term changes going to be? What is the world going to look like after the pandemic? And I'm just curious if you could maybe speculate, do you think there will be long-term changes to the restaurant industry as a result of what you've been through? Or will we indeed get to a point where life really does go back to normal as we once knew it?
You know, it's definitely going to change the restaurant industry. I mean, a lot of us now are geared for takeout delivery, which we weren't before. That also puts on added pressures to the kitchen. So if you have a full restaurant and say we had 100 people in our restaurant, which would be down from 200, but then you also have those 30 or 40 to-go menus, it taxes the kitchen. You can only put, like JJ said, you can only put so much food in an oven at one time. So we don't know what the end game is going to be on this. Hopefully when they get a vaccine, we can go back to a little bit more of normalcy. But I mean, like Chef Paul said, he's got banquets that just really can't happen. You know, we have a lot of pharmaceutical banquets, and they canceled on us and they wanted all their money back. And if we were to try to hold a pharmaceutical event now, the most we could put is 24 people in there. And in our banquet room where, you know, normally they like 50 or 60 people. So I don't think there's a way to answer it, and there's no crystal ball, but it has definitely impacted us, I think, forever.
Well, all of you represent restaurants in the Fresno area that are well-loved and well-known. And on behalf of the community, we wish you all the best. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. COVID-19 and the stay-at-home directives enacted to minimize its spread have led to a shocking decline in employment. For many, the loss of wages means an increased reliance on food distribution centers. The Central California Food Bank works with churches, community centers, and schools to distribute food in Fresno, Madera, Kings, Kern, and Tulare counties.
I spoke with the nonprofit's chief operation officer, Natalie Caples, about how the coronavirus has escalated the Valley's hunger crisis.
Can you give us a sense of how the demand for food has changed since the outbreak of the pandemic?
Yes. So over the last 7 weeks or so, our agency partners have seen anywhere between 40 to 100% increase in families or individuals seeking emergency food services. Obviously, this puts an immense amount of strain on the emergency food network. And so Central California Food Bank is doing everything we can to be able to equip our agencies and provide them with food and fill in gaps maybe where maybe we don't have an existing agency or we are seeing just a high volume of need.
That is absolutely staggering. Can you explain in more detail how your operations have changed to meet this increase in demand?
We're kind of in an interesting position where at a time where we're seeing the increased need for emergency food services, some of our agencies have actually decided to close because of the potential risk that the pandemic presents. So the way that we have been modifying our operations to be able to keep up with the demand is we are partnering with organizations where maybe we haven't partnered with in the past to be able to continue to distribute food. So for us, you know, one of the biggest things in kind of looking at how the pandemic has changed our operations is when an agency closes, do we have the capacity to meet the need on our own? Or do we need to collaborate with other individuals or other community-based organizations to help us meet the need? One of the groups that was identified very early on is our farm working population. We're in a rural community. Ag is our driving, you know, ag really drives our economy. And we were hearing from multiple partners kind of on the ground that our farm workers didn't have access to food distributions when they needed it. And so we're partnering with organizations that are specifically serving those farm workers in the ag community. We're partnering with schools because families, you know, are no longer, kids are no longer in school because of the school closures. Maybe families don't have access to school meals that are currently being provided. And so we're working with local schools, both, you know, city and county and rural areas to be able to meet the growing need of families with kids because school is out and they no longer have access to free and reduced meals. A really exciting partnership that, you know, just recently happened to be, you know, because of the pandemic is Bitwise is launched their Take Care grocery delivery app, where you can request a delivery if, you know, you're immunocompromised or you can't leave the house because you're quarantined or you are in a population that maybe would have a more adverse reaction if you contracted the virus. And so because Bitwise decided to make this investment, their partner is Neighborhood Industries. We've partnered with Neighborhood Industries to provide food. So before, where we didn't have access to individual household delivery, because we are looking at innovative ways to partner, we're looking at community-based organizations that are already doing amazing work, and we're able to partner with them to maximize our reach. So we're just really thankful that we have these opportunities here in the Central Valley. We have people that, you know, in a time of crisis are rallying together to figure out how do we really solve this problem. And so for us, you know, our changing operations is thinking outside of the box, you know, partnering with individuals that maybe have the capacity to do something that we weren't currently doing, and partnering with community-based organizations to really address those gaps in our services.
You spoke about some of the particular populations that you're working to reach, but I'd like to speak about this in terms of geography. Mm-hmm. You serve such a wide geographic area. Have you found that there are certain communities that perhaps have been harder hit compared to other areas?
I think typically what we see across the board is there are less access to services in our rural areas. But I think that we're seeing the effects of this pandemic across the board. Anecdotally, of course, you know, in rural areas, there's less access to, you know, to a grocery store that's within driving distance, or maybe distributions, disproportionately occur during the day. So if you are a part-time worker that's working during the time of the distribution, you can't make it there. there. So there are some other, you know, compounding factors that make it a little bit harder for our rural populations to access services, but just the need across our 5-county service area has spiked. It doesn't matter if you're in Fresno, Visalia, or if you're in Coalinga.
What kind of support have you received through either state or federal aid programs?
Oh, yes, that's complicated. There are a couple of different programs that both the state and federal government are working through to address kind of two different scenarios. So let's tackle the federal program first. The federal government rolled out, I think, in the middle of April, their intention to provide support to food distributors and the ag community because they felt that they were hard hit, you know, by the pandemic. Obviously, with food distributors, you see contracts with, you know, hotels, school districts, restaurants, things like that falling by the wayside because of the shelter in place orders. And the ag industry was also disproportionately affected because they're serving those contracts that food distributors, right, are serving. And so the federal government decided to roll out a farmer to family food box. And this process involved essentially food distributors, ag, dairy, and the protein industry. They could submit a proposal to be able to produce these food boxes, which would then be distributed to a nonprofit entity of their choice. It was a little bit of a complicated process, but through a lot of networking with our member organization, Feeding America, with a lot of really great work from our food acquisitions manager, Jacqueline Pack, we were able to be named as the beneficiary in a few different bids. We probably won't know until next week if one of the proposals that we were included on is going to be awarded the contract. But essentially, if we were awarded that contract, we could potentially be the recipient of essentially what they're calling a mixed box. So we would get a mixed box of produce and potentially an opportunity to receive a mixed box of dairy and protein items. And that's really important because historically, distributing perishable product like dairy and meat, it is a little bit harder for food banks just because of our limited storage capacity, but also because the way that we operate is a hub and spoke model where we typically don't operate direct distributions to the community. One of the primary And there are a couple exceptions to that, but the primary way that we serve our community is through our network of agency partners. We have 180 or so of those agencies across our 5-county service area. And because we have limited cooler and freezer storage capacity, our agencies definitely have limited freezer and cooler storage capacity. Typically, the foods that we distribute to our clients are shelf-stable pantry items. And so this is an amazing opportunity, even though it's a little complicated, to provide clients with food items that they wouldn't typically get through an agency pantry or food distribution. So although nothing is certain yet, we are hoping that we would be the beneficiary of one of those granted contracts. The state government has decided to make an additional investment in a program run by the state association, which is the Farm to Family program. And so they're going to be making a monetary investment in that program, which helps connect farmers and packers and individuals in the ag community to the state association, where they could get a percentage reimbursed for providing product into this farm to family network. And I believe there are anywhere between 40 and 50 food banks in California that could benefit because of the additional investment that the governor announced, I think it was last week.
So one thing that we've seen is a real desire among those in the community whose health and income have not been impacted by COVID-19 mm-hmm. to find a way to be helpful, be productive in this time. Has that translated into an increase in support for Central Valley Food Bank?
We have gotten an amazing response from our community, both in monetary donations and individuals that really are rallying to support the basic need, right? Basic human need, which is one of them is food. And so we're very lucky that we have that we do have a recognizable profile here in the Central Valley. People really are stepping up to meet the need specifically to provide relief during the pandemic. And so we're so grateful for their partnership. We're so grateful that they see the need and they feel the call to act.
And then quickly, before we wrap up, for those listening who need access to food, what should they do?
You can visit our website, which is ccfoodbank.org. We have a food locator on our website. So you could type in your address and it populates agency pantries or distributions that are close to you. And we also have a distribution calendar on our website, which lists what we call neighborhood markets or direct distributions. And these are, think of these distributions like the farmer's market of Central California Food Bank distributions, where we provide a variety of fresh fruits and vegetables, other produce and other items to the community free of charge. So those, it's always the best option to visit our website. We're updating it daily, you know, because things, as we know, during this pandemic, things are constantly changing. And so ccfoodbank.org and our food locator has the most accurate up-to-date information for all of our agency and direct service distributions in our five county service area.
Natalie Caples, thank you so much for being with us and the work you're doing to feed the Central Valley.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate your time and allowing us to talk a little bit about what we're doing.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. As we've seen on our show, the needs in the San Joaquin Valley are growing due to the pandemic. In this audio postcard, FM89's news director Alice Daniel tells us about a woman who used to live on the streets and is now trying to help people experiencing homelessness.
April Imboden knows many places where homeless people live in Fresno. On this day, she's parked her car in an alley near Fruit and Dakota.
You want a piece of pizza? A piece of pizza!
She has a couple of boxes of pizza she's purchased from Little Caesars. And she's passing out slices to folks who might be hungry.
What's your name?
Ronald.
April, nice to meet you, Ronald. Is there anybody in there?
She points to a tent where a woman's voice is barely audible.
Who is that? Is that Rosemary?
Imboden has spent enough time handing out water and food that she sometimes recognizes people. She gives Rosemary a slice and then sings out her name.
Rosemary!
Imboden also carries supplies in her car. Clothes, bottles of water, backpacks.
Hey, Ronald, do you want a backpack?
She offers Ronald a bright blue backpack, and then she turns to Rosemary.
I got a pink sweater. Do you want it?
Rosemary tells her, I don't do pink.
You don't do pink.
Imboden says she wears a mask and uses gloves when she's passing out food. And she's helping because she lived on the streets for 2 years. She had a meth addiction, and she lost the trailer where she was living. In 2018, she got an apartment through a Fresno housing program. She says when she first moved in, a grassroots volunteer organization called Wings helped her furnish the place with donated items. The effort was so thoughtful, she says, she broke down.
It made me cry because I was like, you know, I was thinking I had to do this all by myself, you know?
They even brought her a welcome basket.
So I swore to them that I'm going to go help them, and I haven't stopped.
She's been volunteering for Wings since then, and other organizations, including a recovery center where she got help. One of the volunteers at Wings told me, Imboden sees the best in everyone, and she can single-handedly carry a bed up a flight of stairs. Imboden has a mental illness, so she's on disability. She also has a part-time job at a thrift store, although it's not open now. She says she's always on the lookout for people in need.
Hey, what happened? Did you get a flat?
Like on this day, when she sees a man trying to fix his bike, his belongings in bags next to him. He tells her his derailleur came off and his tools were stolen.
What tool do you need?
She gets out of her car and rummages around in her trunk.
4-in-1 screwdriver. Will that work?
Yes, it will. Because it's a screwdriver. Okay. And a Phillips.
The man says his name is Eddie, and they start talking. Eddie tells her he plays the guitar.
And how does the guitar, I mean, does that help you connect with people and life?
Oh, God, you know, it's...
Yes, Eddie says, it's such a beautiful thing. It opens up so many doors to meeting people.
It also soothes.
The soul.
Oh, man, it soothes the soul. And, you know...
Eddie brings up the story in the Bible about King Saul. When Saul was bothered by evil spirits, only David's harp would make him feel better.
So he could relax and calm down. But without the music, he was, like, mad at everybody.
Was it David from David and Goliath, Imboden asks? Yes, Eddie says. They talk a bit more, and then they say goodbye.
Okay, well, Eddie, are you going to be able to fix your bike?
I should be able to fix my bike, with no problem.
That's good. I'll see you later.
And okay, with that, Imboden drives away, ready to help another person in need. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Alice Daniel.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. When the news broke late last month that Bakersfield's Noriega Hotel was closing its doors for good, it sent shockwaves through the community. As the oldest Basque restaurant in town and a winner of the prestigious James Beard Foundation Award, the Noriega Hotel was an institution. I spoke with Bakersfield, Californian reporter Stephen Mayer, who was the first to report on its closing.
I was hoping you could give us a little sense of the history of the Noriega Hotel.
Yeah, I think going back even before the hotel formed, you have a history in Bakersfield. Of course, Bakersfield's beginning as an agricultural region and still is today. And for some reason, it attracted sheep herders and sheep growers from Spain and that area. And, of course, the Basque region is the Pyrenees Mountains, an area that includes both Spain and France. And a lot of sheep herders made their way to this area and went to work as sheep herders in Central California. Now, a lot of them were alone, they weren't married, they were single men, and so they stayed in boarding houses, and the Noriega Hotel became a boarding house, which means they served them their meals as well. They could sleep there and then come down to the communal dining room and have dinner there as well, and of course, everybody ate the same dinner, so it was a giant family-style situation. And eventually, the hotel was sold to the Elizalde family in 1931, and ultimately they formed a restaurant and ultimately, again, a bar, and that's kind of the short version of how it started.
So that's how it started, but then it went on to have this incredible legacy in Bakersfield. Can you give us a sense of how beloved the Noriega Hotel was?
It's the type of place where I think a lot of residents in Bakersfield take out-of-town visitors. You bring somebody to Bakersfield and you want to share with them something unique about your city or the place you live. And Noriega Hotel was one of those places. It has this 100-plus-year-old history, and it is the type of place that is unlike any other restaurant. Because of this communal dining style, what you end up doing is you go into the bar, you have a couple of drinks. You have to have reservations, by the way, and each night is a different menu. For example, on Saturday, oxtail stew and fried chicken would be the entree. On Wednesday, lamb stew or spare ribs would be another couple of entrees. And, of course, there's all sorts of other food that goes with it. It's very unusual where they just bring plate after plate and platter after platter of all kinds of soup, salad, beans. You have to drop some of the beans into the soup if you know how it's supposed to work. Sourdough bread, which is baked right here in Bakersfield by Pyrenees Bakery. Pickled tongue, cottage cheese, Basque style, pasta, vegetables, blue cheese, house wine, I mean, it just kind of goes on and on. And so when you are able to bring your guests from out of town or out of state to a place like that, they really never forget it. It's different. It's unique to Bakersfield, I think. It was the oldest bachelor restaurant, I believe, in the United States.
And it's part of a large culture of Basque food in Bakersfield.
It is. There are other Basque restaurants that are still here, and I'm hoping after we open up after the pandemic and the lockdown that Wool Growers and Pyrenees Restaurant, Pyrenees Cafe, and other Basque restaurants here will open as well. And while they have very similar food and very similar styles, they are different in that they are not strictly the communal style dining, this family style that are essentially long tables that reach across the entire dining room, and you end up sitting next to other families or strangers, and you get to know them, and it becomes quite an atmosphere.
You were able to speak with one of the co-owners of the Noriega Hotel about their decision to close. What did she have to say?
Rochelle Ladd is one of the sisters who have been running the restaurant for decades. And while many people suspected that it was kind of the whole COVID-19 pressures that finally made them decide to call it quits, she said that they had been coming to that decision for actually quite a while. Now, COVID-19 might have played a part in it, and probably did, but there are other issues that they have been dealing with. One of them is a very simple issue. Both Rochelle and her sister are in their mid-60s or a little bit older, so they're reaching retirement age, and she expressed to me that they're kind of ready. You know, they're just kind of ready to retire. And running a restaurant, as I think most people know, is a very demanding job. And so I think they knew they were coming to the end. And this was one reason. There were, of course, other reasons. Noriega Hotel is in what we call Old Town Kern, which is a very old part of town. And it's also got a lot of problems with blight and homeless street people, and sometimes property crimes and other issues that keep some people from driving over there. I have never had a problem there, but, you know, it scares some people because it doesn't look like a brand new spanking place. It really is old, and to me it makes it more unique, but for some it is kind of a stumbling block for them to enjoy it. So that may be part of the issue as well.
And how is the community responding to the news that it's gone forever?
I would say with sorrow, great sorrow, and also well wishes for the family. But I really think that a lot of people here, thousands of people, have expressed dismay over the decision and also, you know, sorrow over the loss of this restaurant, which is considered by many to be part of our identity as a community. So the Bakersfield isn't just losing a restaurant, it's really losing a piece of itself.
And while COVID-19 was probably only a factor in its closure, the fact that it closed during a time when the community did not have an opportunity to say goodbye and is also dealing with this period of frustration being stuck in their homes, I would imagine that's probably contributed to the amount of sorrow that the community is expressing.
Yeah, they really didn't get their sort of swan song. They didn't get that celebration, that gold watch, all of those things that we get when we come to an ending that's planned. This one, unfortunately, simply came as an announcement on social media that they would not open post-COVID. And I think it did play a part in this level of sorrow. I mean, I think it really caused some people to draw real tears, to cry real tears over this. And others have been talking about ways to save it or ways to continue it, even if the sisters sold it or somehow worked with a new owner to continue the tradition. But that's dicey, and nobody knows if that'll work.
Well, we appreciate you taking the time to be with us and commemorate this bit of Valley history.
My pleasure.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. This weekend, why not tune into a home concert? Visalia musician Rudy Paris has been hosting a live stream performance on his Facebook every Friday and Saturday night for the past 6 weeks, where he plays a little of everything, country, classic rock, and his own songs. Paris is known for his time on the competition show The Voice, and has spent the last year singing with the Buckaroos, the backup band of Bakersfield country legend Buck Owens. Valley Public Radio's Laura Satsui spoke to Paris from his Visalia home and put together this audio postcard with some of Paris's live stream performances.
I've been doing this for 38 years professionally, but I started playing music in 1976. I had 50 shows booked for 2020, so I lost 50 shows, and that's throughout the year. I've been in my home and doing what I'm told as far as this whole pandemic thing. You know, the way I look at it is like, you know, I don't want to be caught the cause of somebody else's health issues. So early on, I got the idea from a friend of mine to go live, and I've always thought about it, but I've never did it. And he said, man, do it tonight. And I was like, okay, I'm going to do it. There's so much to do. It's when you do this at the level that I'm trying to do it at, it's about 10 times more work than just going out and playing a gig. I mean, every weekend I have to come up with about 20 songs, and you know, this is my 15th broadcast, so you know, you do the math. It's tough to keep it fresh, but because I've been doing it for 38 years and I'm a multi-genre artist, you know, it's a little easier, but there's still a lot involved in selecting material. Some people just, you know, they'll get their acoustic guitar and they'll set their phone up and just play. And I set up a whole system like I'm playing live. Yeah, I'm the lighting director, I'm a production manager, you know, I'm doing it all. Sound engineer, singer, guitar player, you name it. The idea that, you know, during this really negative, tough time for people, that I'm able to bring joy to a lot of people. You know, I get a lot of letters and comments and stuff of how, you know, this song, you know, you made me cry, and you made me think about this person or that person, you know, so maybe people have passed away, or you just bring a lot of joy into our household. My thing is, music is very sacred to me, and if you're gonna do it, you know, don't toy around with it. I mean, be serious and give 110%, and that's what I try to do. When I play off an audience. That's my main thing. I read an audience and I play off their vibe, and it's kind of like doing this, you're just doing it and it's going out into the abyss. Like, you don't know, you don't know what's going on. You don't know what, are they smiling? Are they, you know, are they dancing around? Are they, I mean, what's happening? That feeling is a bit strange and something that kind of bothers me. A lot of people ask for lots of Merle Haggard. I mean, you wouldn't believe how many people ask for Merle Haggard. I found this backing track of a song called Sit Here and Drink. And the bass line was real R&B. It wasn't like the record, it was more like blues. And that was, I had a blast doing that. I really dug that. But my favorite thing about the Haggard stuff is his ballads is what I really, really enjoy singing. Yes, you know the way I feel, yeah. You take all the money right from the bank. Recently, as of last year, I was asked to front and sing for the Buckaroos. So we have a show called Rudy Paris with the Buckaroos there. And I'm playing with the legendary, iconic band leader, Jim Shaw. He's a keyboard player, and he's the one that ran Flux Publishing and Music Master Rights and played keyboard for Buck. And he was also on Hee Haw with Buck. My entire family, we used to watch Hee Haw every Saturday, and that was one of our things, you know. And then we'd watch Pop Goes the Country. My mom and dad were big fans of country music, and when they asked me to be in the band, my mom couldn't believe it. She was like, "I can't believe they asked you to play with them. That's incredible." And she, you know, so she got to see that before she passed, and that was cool. Happy that people are enjoying what I'm doing. I'm just hoping that people aren't putting me in a box and going, "Oh, he probably can't do that." You know, that's what I tell people when they've never really seen me or they haven't experienced what I do. I'm like, don't be shy. You never know what I'm gonna do. You know, I've prided myself in people shouting out songs, and I'm able to go into it. Been able to accomplish things in the music industry that some people, like maybe lived in New York or Nashville or LA, haven't accomplished. And I did it all from Visalia. And, you know, I think the thing that drove me was the fact that Merle Haggard and Buck Owens did the same thing from Bakersfield. You know, so it's been a blessing.
That was Rudy Paris, a Visalia-based musician who is live-streaming concerts from his home every Friday and Saturday night on Facebook. You could find links to watch his live stream at kvpr.org. And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all of this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Laura Satsui, and Madi Bolaños. Technical support from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, standing with all Californians as we address the coronavirus emergency together on the web at chcf.org.